President Joe Biden reacts to the International Criminal Court.
We reject the ICC's application for arrest warrants against Israeli leaders. Whatever these warrants may imply, there is no equivalence between Israel and Hamas.
Plus, the situation in Ukraine remains difficult amid Russian attacks.
Russia's attacks in the Kharkiv region since May 10th have already forced the evacuation of around 10,500 people, according to local officials' estimates.
And later, how have Egypt's fortunes changed after October 7th? And a look at the worldwide reaction to the death of the Iranian president. Today is Tuesday, May 21st, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Before October 7th, talks were in the works for a deal in the Middle East to normalize relations between Saudi Arabia and Israel in exchange for security guarantees from the U.S. And while the events of October 7th stopped any talk of a deal, things are beginning to change. On Monday, the United States described as near final a bilateral defense pact with Saudi Arabia that, once completed, would be part of a bigger deal presented to Israel to decide whether to make concessions to secure normalization with Riyadh. Jack Lew is the American ambassador to Israel. He says there are still some important steps yet to go before a deal can be finalized.
We've said for a long time that we're willing to do some difficult things in terms of the bilateral peace with the United States and Saudi Arabia, and we're making very good progress on that. I think the peace that involves Israel is going to be, it's going to be a complicated conversation because it's going to require two things. There's going to have to be some period of quiet, I think, in Gaza, and there's going to have to be a conversation about how do you deal with the question of the future of Palestinian governance. My view is that strategic benefit is worth taking the risk of getting into that conversation about, but that's a decision that the government of Israel will have to make and the people of Israel will have to make.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has long promoted such a deal, but 7 months into a war with Hamas militants in the Gaza Strip, a ceasefire remains elusive, and he says it's premature to discuss day after Palestinian rule. On Monday's program, we told you about the International Criminal Court and the prosecutor's efforts to arrest leaders of Hamas and Israel for alleged war crimes. It's not surprising that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu would object. After all, he's one of the accused. But U.S. President Joe Biden also objected, emphatically, to the accusations, saying there's no equivalency between Israel and Hamas. Gabe Singer of Reuters has more.
U.S. President Joe Biden strongly defended Israel on Monday after the International Criminal Court's prosecutor requested arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his defense chief and three Hamas leaders over alleged war crimes. Biden was speaking at an event for Jewish American Heritage Month at the White House.
Let me be clear. We reject the ICC's application for arrest warrants against Israeli leaders. Whatever these warrants may imply, there is no equivalence between Israel and Hamas. And it's clear Israel wants to do all it can to ensure civilian protection. But let me be clear. Contrary to allegations against Israel made by the International Court of Justice, what's happening is not genocide.
ICC prosecutor Karim Khan said in a statement issued after more than 7 months of war in Gaza that he had reasonable grounds to believe the five men, quote, bear criminal responsibility for alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity. He said evidence his office collected showed Israel had systematically deprived civilians of, quote, objects indispensable to human survival, including food, water, medicine, and energy. Netanyahu on Monday called the charges absurd.
As the Prime Minister of Israel, I reject with disgust the comparison of the prosecutor in The Hague between democratic Israel and the mass murderers of Hamas. This is a complete distortion of reality.
The Hamas leaders are accused of bearing responsibility for crimes committed by the militant group, including extermination and murder, the taking of hostages, torture, rape, and other acts of sexual violence. Many Gazans were also angry over news of the warrants.
We are against this decision because they have equated the victim with the executioner. We have a right to our homeland. How can it be that those who resist and call for the liberation of their homeland become criminal, and the criminal becomes the protector?
The ICC is the world's first permanent international war crimes court. It steps in only when a state is unwilling or genuinely unable to do so itself. Israel has said alleged war crimes in Gaza are being investigated domestically. It and key ally the United States are not members of the ICC, along with China and Russia.
That's Reuters' Gabe Singer reporting. And even as the Israeli leaders deny war crimes and lash out at the ICC, it's not stopping them from taking other controversial measures. Israeli officials have seized equipment belonging to the Associated Press and taken down a live broadcast from northern Gaza, citing the country's much-criticized new media law. For more, visit the Press Freedom page at voanews.com. Last fall, Egypt was on the brink of economic collapse. A decade of debt-fueled spending had emptied its central bank. By February, Cairo's public debt was 89% of its gross domestic product. External debt had soared to 46% of GDP. Annual inflation was over 35% and double that for some food staples. Egypt, it seemed, was on the verge of default, its first ever. And then came October 7th. For a look at Egypt's changing fortunes, I'm joined by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Judith Miller.
As horrible as October 7th was for the Israelis and, of course, you know, for the Palestinians, it was actually a boon to Egypt because on the verge of October 7th, Egypt was about to basically go broke. For the first time in its 5,000-year history, Egypt did not have enough hard currency in its central bank to pay the interest on all of the money that it had borrowed. And so once the war began, the United States, which has a 16.9% share of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, which had cut Egypt off for failing to adhere to its commitments, the United States decided we just cannot have the largest Arab country in the Middle East and the first Arab country to make peace with Israel go belly up. So they leaned on the IMF to restore the money that had been cut off and increase it to $8 billion. Then the European Union chipped in $7 billion, and the UAE, United Arab Emirates, went through with a $35 billion purchase of a northern peninsula in Egypt. And that gave them basically $50 billion, or what they need now to pay the interest that they owe on their debt. So basically, Egypt was saved by October 7th.
As you pointed out, Egypt was in fairly dire straits financially before October 7th. With all this money coming in, were there any structural changes to the way Egypt manages its economy so that something like this won't happen again?
That is the $64,000 question, as we used to say. Egypt has made a number of commitments to the IMF and to people who have lent, countries that have lended it money, about how it's going to straighten out its financial mess. And it is a financial mess. Egypt is spending much more than it can afford. It is building a new capital for some $58 billion outside of Cairo. It is overspending. And it's spending like a drunken sailor, and it doesn't have the income, it doesn't have the imports to support the exports to support that. So, yeah, I mean, Egypt must straighten out its financial house. It must put its financial house in order. And the question is, will President Sisi do that? Because he hasn't been willing to do it before.
So along with the influx of investment after October 7th, Egypt also became sort of politically more relevant, more important by working with the Qataris and the Americans on the peace talks. Can you explain how the political importance has also increased their fortunes?
Yes, Egypt has always prided itself on being the leader of the Arab world. And because of its financial problems and because it has had such a stormy political situation for the past, 10 years now, its diplomatic standing in the region has fallen, and it's been taken over by Qatar, which has almost no people but a great deal of money, and the UAE, ditto, and that really grates at Egypt. And it, by the way, it's important not only to the leadership of the country. Ordinary Egyptians take pride in their leadership role in diplomacy. And so now, because Egypt is a leader in the negotiations with Israel and Hamas over returning the hostages to Israel and getting a ceasefire or a temporary ceasefire for the Palestinians, its standing has been elevated, and that is also very useful to the government. And I think it's a very important to have Egypt play that role, because the Israelis who work very closely with Egypt trust the Egyptians with diplomacy more than they trust Qatar.
So, what about going forward? Will this change the dynamic between the Egyptians and the Gazans, the Egyptians and the Israelis?
Well, there is no love lost between Egypt and the Gazans, the Palestinians of Gaza. Egypt actually ruled Gaza for a long period of time, and they did not relish that role. They couldn't wait to get rid of it. And the Palestinians have just been extremely problematic wherever they've gone. And the Egyptians, who have been fighting a battle against the Islamic State in their Sinai desert for over 10 years, a battle, I might add, that they helped quell thanks to Israeli help. They don't want Hamas infiltrating the country and coming in with Palestinians from Gaza. So the Egyptians and the Israelis, neither one of them want mass migration from Israel into Egypt right now, because that's seen as destabilizing.
Judith Miller is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and adjunct fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Ms. Miller, thanks for your time. Thanks for your analysis on this topic.
Thank you.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. An update from Kyiv in just a moment, but our look at the situation in Ukraine begins with a look at Washington's reassurances to Ukraine on Monday that it will continue to provide support to counter the Russian offensive. Meanwhile, though, analysts warn the humanitarian crisis is deepening, particularly in the Kharkiv region, where Moscow's forces are building a buffer zone. Veronica Balderas Iglesias has the story.
While Ukraine's forces are in a hard fight with Russia, they are skilled and have the unwavering support of the United States and other partners. That was the key message that U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin delivered after the latest meeting of the roughly 50-nation Ukraine Defense Contact Group.
We spent a lot of time today on life-saving air defense systems, which are helping Ukraine stave off waves of Russian missiles, Iranian UAVs, and North Korean munitions. And we'll continue to push to ensure that Ukraine owns its skies and can defend its citizens and its civilian infrastructure far from the front lines.
Ukraine's defense capabilities are also being boosted by a $1 billion military aid package recently authorized by U.S. President Joe Biden. The support comes as Russian troops launch new attacks in Kharkiv and aim to establish a new buffer zone along the Ukrainian border, warned Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman General C.Q. Brown Jr.
Russia anticipates that this will divert Ukrainian focus and capabilities from other critical areas. Ukraine has made concerted efforts to build and strengthen defensive lines, which are being tested by Russian attacks.
On Friday, Russian President Vladimir Putin said the buffer zone was a protective measure against Ukrainian attacks. He said he blames Kyiv because Ukraine shelled and continues shelling residential areas of border territories inside Russia.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky affirms that his troops have secured stronger positions in the Kharkiv region. But during an interview with Reuters on Monday, he also lamented the delays in Western weaponry, saying that had Ukraine received Patriot missile batteries in the beginning, when few drones were operating and when Russia was using missiles, and had the Russians seen the missiles being shot down, they would have understood that it was pointless to target energy infrastructure on a massive scale. Russia's military gains on the ground have also worsened the humanitarian crisis in Ukraine, experts point out. William Pomerantz is a Russia expert at the Wilson Center. He spoke with VOA via Zoom.
They have made gains in the Kharkiv region, and I don't think Putin or his generals are in any mindset to back down at all.
Russia's attacks in the Kharkiv region since May 10th have already forced the evacuation of around 10,500 people, according to local officials' estimates. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
In Veronica's story, we heard about Lloyd Austin and the meeting of the Ukraine Defense Contact Group. With more details on the international participants and President Zelensky's call for more air defense amid increasing Russian attacks, here's VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova in Kyiv.
On May 20th, Monday, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, during the 22nd meeting of the Contact Group on Defense of Ukraine, emphasized the need for a permanent supply of weapons to Kyiv. Austin said that the meeting is taking place at a moment of challenge, when Russian forces have launched another offensive, trying to achieve advances and try to create a buffer zone along the Ukrainian border. According to Austin, the U.S. continues to supply the armed forces of Ukraine with all the necessary assistance, in particular, ammunition for the NASAMS and Patriot air defense systems, HIMARS systems, Stinger anti-aircraft missiles, and Javelin and AT-4 anti-tank systems. As a result of the meeting, the Netherlands announced the provision of the YPR-765 infantry fighting vehicle to Ukraine. Germany created an initiative to fund air defense systems for Ukraine. According to the report, Belgium, Denmark, Canada, the Netherlands, and Norway will participate. In addition, Belgium, Great Britain, Spain, Lithuania, Romania, the US, and France have promised to help with equipment and missiles, and Latvia has expressed a desire to join the initiative. On Tuesday, Annalena Baerbock, Federal Minister for Foreign Affairs of Germany, arrived in Kyiv on her seventh visit since the start of the full-scale Russian invasion. Baerbock announced that the German initiative to strengthen Ukrainian air defense has already raised almost €1 billion. The purpose of her visit is to assure that despite the worsening of the situation in the war zone, Germany and Europe will continue to firmly stand by Ukraine and will continue to provide support.
Говорив сьогодні з головкомом щодо ситуації, зокрема на Донецьких напрямках, на Харківщині, всюди зберігаємо.
Meanwhile, President Volodymyr Zelensky in his evening address said that Ukrainian forces maintain control in the Donetsk and Kharkiv regions, but the situation there is extremely tough. Zelensky mentioned that Russian forces are actively using guided aerial bombs in the areas of Chasiv Yar and Pokrovsk in the Donetsk region and in the area of Lipetsk in the Kharkiv region and in other combat areas. He said that Ukraine needs much more air defense capacities, mainly additional air defense systems to protect Ukrainian cities and help Ukrainian soldiers implement defense actions on the battlefield. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And finally today, the deaths of Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi and Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian in a helicopter crash sparked reaction from world leaders on Monday. Heads of state from Pakistan, Russia, and Lebanon remembered Raisi as a respected leader, while the United States acknowledged his troubled human rights record. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
5 days of national mourning as Iranians mark the deaths of President Ibrahim Raisi and Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian in a helicopter crash Sunday. The United States expressed its official condolences for the deaths, but acknowledged Raisi's role in human rights abuses, including the extrajudicial killing of political prisoners in 1988. Matthew Miller is the spokesperson for the U.S. State Department.
We regret any loss of life. We don't want to see anyone die in a helicopter crash. But that doesn't change the reality of his record, both as a judge and as the president of Iran, the fact that he has blood on his hands.
Iran's vice president, Mohammad Mokhber, now serving as acting president, said the deaths would not cause domestic unrest. But Iranians in exile celebrated Monday, saying this could be a moment of change. Javad Dabrayan, the spokesperson for the National Council of Resistance of Iran, says this is definitely an encouragement for the people in Iran, who have also been protesting until now, and it will definitely bring the resistance in Iran a big step forward.
This is definitely an encouragement for the people in Iran who have also been protesting until now. It will definitely bring the resistance in Iran a big step forward.
One analyst told VOA that Raisi's death would likely not have a significant impact on U.S.-Iran relations. Alex Vitanka is the Iran program director at the Middle East Institute.
In the context of Iran and the Islamic Republic, on those very key issues, and U.S.-Iran relations is one of them, he was not the most important of voices. That is an issue that Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, keeps very much to himself.
Elsewhere in the world, leaders mourned Raisi. Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan,
I would like to express the deep sorrow we feel for this tragic accident.
Allah'tan rahmet niyaz ediyorum.
Pakistan observed a day of mourning in Raisi's honor. Pakistani Foreign Minister Ishaq Dar says it is a very sad day for the Islamic holy community.
It is a very sad day for the Islamic Ummah. We are all very sad, and so are the Muslims in the great country of Turkey, Pakistan, and Islamic Ummah.
Russian state television anchor Daria Kozlova shared a tribute to Raisi from President Vladimir Putin.
The Russian leader noted that Raisi had been an outstanding politician and, as a true friend of Russia, made an invaluable personal contribution to development of good neighborly relations between our countries and made great efforts to bring them to the level of strategic partnership.
And the Chinese foreign ministry said Raisi had played a key role in the alliance between China and Iran. Chinese foreign ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbing,
President Raisi made significant contributions to maintaining Iran's security and stability and promoting the country's development and prosperity. He also made active efforts to strengthen and develop the comprehensive strategic partnership between China and Iran.
Iran will hold elections within 50 days to elect a permanent president. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.